your valuation is going to be on the numbers. You could build an amazing brand. You could have great team, great culture, but your valuation is on the numbers.
Welcome back to Fifth Wave. I'm Jeffrey Young, Editor-in-Chief of Fifth Wave. In today's episode, we're returning to our funding mini-series and speaking with entrepreneur Ed Barry about scaling and ultimately selling a coffee business. Ed is the former owner of London-based independent coffee chain Over Under. He founded and grew Over Under to a formidable 8-strong chain, plus a franchise in the Middle East, before selling the business to ambitious New York-based startup Blank Street in 2022. Following the acquisition, Ed has set up a hospitality tech platform, Edify Systems. In this candid conversation, Ed shares his experience of the M&A process, from preparing the business for sale to lengthy due diligence, and then managing the transition period. He also highlights the importance of meticulous planning and ensuring continued financial performance during the sales process while balancing all the grueling activities related to the deal. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you, Jeff. Great to be here.
I wonder if you give us a little bit of background on yourself and how you first got into hospitality.
So I started working in pubs, restaurants, cafes, probably when I was about 12 or 13. It was summer jobs, winter jobs, throughout my childhood. And I just loved it. I loved the hustle and bustle of hospitality. And then I went to university in Ireland and put my hospitality work on the back burner for a few years and then moved to New York. And I was this nanny that looked after this family on the Upper East Side. Yep. And I ended up having a lot of free time. Yeah. And so ended up going to all the different coffee shops around New York. And I just fell in love with the hustle and bustle of hospitality and especially the coffee scene in New York. And I just thought, I kind of had my exposure to it. And I thought, shit, we can do something like this in London and especially West London.
Okay, so New York was the inspiration. You came to London?
Came to London and I had never kind of worked as a barista. So I ended up coming back to London in kind of May 2016 and ended up working in a whole different range of coffee shops. So I worked in big chains. I worked in small independents. I had a coffee cart on Chatsworth Road that we would run every Sunday. And I just, first of all, wanted to learn how to make a really good cup of coffee, really understand what makes a good cup of coffee from lots of different experiences. Yeah. And I think that's where it kind of carved out what we wanted to do at Over Under, which was great coffee, not pretentious, fast service. Yeah. And that was the basis of kind of what we built it on from my learnings really in from New York and from London.
From that point, when was Over Under born?
We opened the doors in February 2017 and our first location was in Earl's Court. And it was this tiny hole in the wall, 300 square foot cafe. It was an old kind of phone shop. And day one we opened, it was all looking amazing. And then the whole thing flooded. And so we had to close day one and then relaunch day two. And it was a huge success from the start. I think, you know, all of you, whenever you open a new venue, you get as many friends and family coming to support. And that drives, you know, a lot of traffic and that brings the buzz, you know. And I think you can never underestimate the value of all of your friends and family being a huge part of that driving force of any kind of business.
At that time, obviously, as business evolved, what were you thinking? Was it just a one-off coffee shop at the time that you just thought, this is cool, I want to have my own shop? Or was there an intention already at that first moment to go, I'm going to open more than that, you know?
There was definitely an intention to roll out. But I think first and foremost, we were like, look, we need to get this first one right. We can't expand to a second location if we kind of are just still figuring out what we're doing. And unfortunately, that's exactly what I did, which was just open the second one way too quickly without really understanding why our customers come to us, what is good about us, like why do our team like working here? But it was always to open more than one. And I think we were fortunate and we picked a great location to start with. We had a really good team. Our customers really liked us in that first location. And so it gave us a really good foundation to grow and expand.
was that close to home for, you know, like, so it's sort of a neighborhood that you kind of wanted to hang out in as well?
I grew up in Oxford, so I didn't grow up in London, but I just thought West London, all the cool shops were opening in East London around that time. So I was like, actually, we could bring something cool, fun, vibrant. And in Earl's Court, there was Greg's, Paul, Nero, Pret, Costa, Starbucks, and there was no independent. So I was like, you know, there's clearly a demand for coffee in this area. Can we do something slightly more bespoke, slightly more independent to kind of complement the high street chains, I suppose?
And was it started with business partners, or how did you fund it? What was the structure of the early days?
So the early days, I had a friend from New York that was kind of our financial partner.
Yep.
And then I had savings from my work. And then we raised something like £50,000 from friends and family to start with to kind of get us off the ground. And then we took a debt facility from the UK government, which was that, I think it was a £25,000 startup loan, which you pay back over 5 years. And I would highly recommend to anyone starting a business to do that. It's a personal loan for business use. And it was a great way for us to start.
And so tell us more. So how did the business evolve over the next couple of years?
So the next couple of years, we opened our second shop in Soho, in the heart of Soho, in one of the retail units in Ham Yard Hotel. And we got asked by one of our regular customers, who was the creative director there, who was like, look, you should come in. We love Over Under. You should come into Soho. And we were living in our own bubble. Everyone had heard about Over Under. We thought it was amazing. Yeah. Nobody outside Earl's Court knew who we were. And we went into Soho and we found it very, very difficult. Yeah. You know, there were more independents. There was a lot more competition. We picked a location that wasn't particularly great, didn't have a huge amount of natural footfall. And we really, really struggled with that one. And that was a huge, huge, huge learning experience for us. And I think what it definitely made us realize is top line and revenue can solve all of your financial challenges. And we just didn't have the top line for us to make it work.
And then third venue,
we opened a small kind of grab and go unit in West Brompton, which was just around the corner from Earl's Court. And that was great. Really, really small, really low rent. You could run it on 1.5 or 2 people per day. That was a really fun unit. And it was just a great driver for profitability. Very high margin. We sold a lot of lot of beverage, not a huge amount of food, which was in contrast to our original site, which was about 50-50 split between food and beverage. And then that kind of gave us the base to then start our kind of first round of fundraising. And, you know, I think based on that, we had 2 really good, really successful, really profitable locations. Yep. And we were like, look, here's the plan. Here's what we want to do over the next basically 3 to 5 years. Yep. It costs us roughly between £100,000 and £150,000 at the time per store to open it. And we think we can do between £600,000 and £750,000 in top line per store, roughly at a 25% margin, which means your payback would be just under 2 years. And that's kind of how we scoped it. That's how we looked at raising based on that kind of forecast. And that started the whole process and actually got us thinking, well, actually, what do we want from the business? How are we going to do it? How are we going to run it? And then trying to execute on that plan.
And did you raise the funds you needed and you wanted?
Yeah, we did. We did 2 rounds of fundraising over the 5 year after our initial seed round. We did 2 big rounds of funding, roughly about, I think, 400,000 each. And yeah, it was great. And we grew. We ended up having 4 or 5 locations just before COVID. Yeah. And then I think we did our 1 final fundraise just before COVID hit. And then that changed everything. So we had these very exciting plans, very exciting trajectory. And then the world collapsed. Yeah. And that was actually, it was a great opportunity for us as a business to like strip back all unnecessary costs, really understand what is driving our business, but also then just trying to keep the business alive and trying to not die, basically.
And you got it to where before you sold it to Blank Street?
Yeah, so we sold to Blank Street in, I think the deal went through in September 2022. And we had 8 locations in the UK and we had a franchise business in the Middle East. And it was a really, really exciting opportunity. We kind of came back after COVID, did really well. We had purchased a few sites kind of opportunistically and ended up getting into, I think we got, I can't remember, quite remember how, but we got introduced to the Blank Street team I just thought, you know, what they were doing in New York is these kind of small format locations, trying to grow it quite quickly, you know, simple coffee, using great machinery, small format, small locations, and trying to do something unpretentious. And I thought it felt kind of like a very similar to kind of what we were trying to do in London.
Yeah.
And I think I got put in touch with the founding team and just said, look, you know, I know you're coming to London, would happily like show you around.
Yeah.
And got introduced to the new MD, Ignacio, and another guy, Brian, who was the head of strategy. Yeah. And we got on really well. And they were, I think that as part of their kind of growth into the UK, they wanted to kind of hit the ground running.
Yeah.
And part of that was to kind of buy our business and roll it into Blank Street as part of their growth strategy into the UK.
Very smart from their part as well.
I hope so.
Great locations, like with... in a cool area that's sort of ready-made network for them.
And it kind of complement, they were looking, a lot of their sites were on kind of central and east London, and we had a lot in the west. So it was quite
no overlap.
It was no overlap, quite complementary. And they were, I mean, I think you also, you know, you end up running your business in the way that you think you should run your business. You know, I started it when I was 26, and you know, you do things a certain way that you think it is, and then you go and join a new business and you work with new people, and it's a very, you know, you see how businesses can run in very different ways. And like, I learned so much from working at Blank Street. It was an amazing team, huge energy, very data-driven, really exciting, really fun, and full of people that had a lot of very different experience. And I think that's what, for us, not only for me, but also like, our core leadership team kind of joined Blank Street and have done amazing opportunity for them that maybe we couldn't have given them at Over Under.
Yeah.
And I think for us and our team, it was just an awesome, awesome opportunity to further all of our careers, really. And, you know, what Blank Street are doing now in the UK is awesome. It really is. And it was really fun to work at. And you see it from the outside. You then see it from working on the inside. And a lot of smart people, really fun people that are doing really cool stuff.
But you must have had a pretty kind of sharp business to be able to attract them. What do you think allowed you to build it so quickly and to very speedily like that?
I think that over the years, the more and more that you run your business, you understand it a lot better. You understand what makes it work. And I think we definitely got to that towards the end. We understood that, look, we take slightly smaller format. We have simple coffee offering, simple food offering that's made on site, and we can do it quite quickly. And those were the kind of three things. And I think the fourth thing is when we were the number one coffee operator on Deliveroo within the UK. But that was a huge driver from COVID. We were like, actually, you know, people still want breakfast, they still want their coffee. And we managed to find like just a really simple spill-free technique that worked and is now used across every Blank Street globally that was kind of born from Over Under. So I think being able to, you know, tackle all those channels was a huge advantage.
So, I mean, seems to me a smart, classic, millennial design business a very, very smart, very millennial business. So it was kind of, the glove was ready to fit.
I think, it was also a timing perspective. Like, I think it probably only would have only made sense for Blank Street right at the start of their journey into the UK.
Yeah.
Because it just allowed them to like really hit the ground running. And I think that was a huge part. We shared a lot of our learnings from the start about kind of London, and you know, then that helped form the basis of Blank Street as they grow and in the UK. And I think, you know, the other thing is that they had, it was a fresh new brand. We ended up coming up with a strategy. We didn't want, you know, we'd seen what happened when other coffee shops, you know, merged together, is that if you do everything at once, you know, you change everything at once, it kind of, things can go wrong quite quickly. So we took a very like structured approach, and Ignacio and I were leading that together, but you know, he was just like, look, let's just take it store by store, slowly by slowly, making sure that all the team are like incredibly comfortable with the transition. And that was difficult. That was very challenging to do, because I'd been thinking about this going through the negotiations for like 6 or 7 months. And I was like, right, let's go. But no one else I think, you know, we kept it very internal and very private about selling the business.
Yeah.
And they were, and we just put a really solid plan in place of how we communicate, transition. We did one-to-ones with all the team. And I think it, you know, I think it went well in terms of an integration from a people perspective. And I think there are lots of people that were a big part of Overunder's journey that have gone on to be a big part of Blank Street's journey.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool to see.
Wow, fabulous. And what about the systems you had in place? You know, you've given me the impression you had quite a slick operation. I mean, your, you know, financial reporting, other systems, your tech stack, was all that pretty much in place? You know, when it comes to due diligence, you've got to be able to present the numbers in a credible way and, you know, be on top of your numbers. Yeah. Was the finance side of it all sort of bolted up in order to be able to present that to investors or buyers or,
I mean, I think that was the, I think probably a year before we sold, you know, we had like quarterly advisory meeting with some of our investors, some of our advisors. And I think we just were like, look, what do we want to do with the business? And we sat down probably a year before selling. And I was like, look, actually, I don't want to do this forever and ever and ever. And I need to put the business in a position where we can actually sell it. And part of that was like, one, we need to make sure all of our financials are, you know, really, really clear, really, really tidy. All of our numbers are like fully traceable. Second one is we built, you know, we had a data room that was there ready to go. So you have all of your, you know, where you have all of your leases, where you have all of your, all of your agreements, any employee contracts, like there's a whole list of stuff that you need to have together, ready to go, which takes a bit of time to organize. Most of it was kind of stuck in my emails from years and years.
Yeah.
And so pulling that ready. And then actually when we got introduced to Blank Street, they were like, hey, we're going to start the due diligence process. And we were like, here it is.
Great.
And so that was what we wanted to do. And that was what worked out. And I suppose the biggest learning from my side on the sale process is, Jeff, you probably know the organization. Like if you can be really, really diligent in terms of your organization, of all the data and the due diligence that you're sharing, you need to be urgent in your responses. You need to like manage all of that. You need to make sure that, you know, you are communicating really well with both legal teams and you're kind of in the middle and you want the deal to go through, but legal are doing all this stuff. And, you know, that was a huge, huge learning curve that, you know, we were very fortunate to have really, really good advisors and friends that helped along the way.
Good advisors and friends. That's another key success.
Key.
What other learnings did you have in this process, like along the actual sale process? Is there anything in terms of negotiation, anything you might have done differently?
I think once the team, we kind of signed a letter of intent, which was like, based on the information we've seen, we are moving forward with buying the business. I think at that point, I was like very, very ready to sell the business. And I think what I probably didn't do is that in the interim period during the due diligence process, I probably took my eye off the ball on operating the business because I was so focused on trying to sell the business. And that meant sometimes, you know, your numbers were not where they needed to be. And actually that was my biggest learning. It was just, you know, after 1 month, our numbers were slightly slipping. I was like, no, we got to make sure, you know, if the worst comes to worst and the business doesn't sell, you still have got to make sure that you're running a really solid business. And I think that was, one learning is making sure that you just keep your eye on the ball when you're trying to sell the business and you're in that process. I think that the other thing is your valuation going to be on the numbers. You know, you could build an amazing brand, you could have great team, great culture, but your valuation is on the numbers. Generally speaking, you know, there might be some other strategic approach, but your benchmark across your numbers, you might have, you know, some multiplier that because you've got a really strong brand, they might value that more. But I think maybe this was just part of our deal is that our brand, the strategy was that we're going to take Overunder and we want to merge it into one business. And so the brand is eventually going to stop, I suppose. And so we were just like, well, actually, you got to make sure that the numbers are really, really good. Yeah. And if you can demonstrate that every new site you open has a payback period that you can forecast and that actually you can kind of predict or forecast with a certain degree of accuracy that this is what we think it's going to make, it just makes it much easier to put a number on a deal.
For you, it was perfect timing. And obviously, if you'd already built a data room before, you'd actually had advisors and doing quarterly advisory stuff. So was the Blank Street thing out of the blue, or had you already committed, you're already kind of resolute that you wanted to sell before the Blank Street opportunity came along?
I think I was just continuing to open shops. We were opening shops, growing, building our team, growing, opening shops. Mm-hmm. And I kind of felt that, you know, there was no like end goal.
Yeah.
To that. That's what I was just kind of doing. And I didn't have this like one thing to like work towards.
Yeah.
And so I was like, look, I eventually want to be able to sell the business. But in order to do that, I need to make the business sellable. I need to get it into a position to be able to do that. And for me, what that meant was, one, you have a really strong operation. You know, you have strong financials. You have a brand that can be strong. And then you have, you know, everything organized in one place that if someone comes, that's what you can do.
Yeah.
And then we got introduced to Blank Street and that started the process.
What type of data is an investor looking for? You know, you don't have to give us the specifics of the Blank Street stuff, but like there's a lot of stuff that you don't realize you have to give.
I mean, I think there's also, you know, when you have a business that you've been running for 5 years, there's just a lot of stuff that if you're coming in as like an American business coming in to buy a UK business, they're just different ways of doing things. Also, we were twice the age of Blank Street when they bought us. You know, I think we were only 2 years old. We were 5 years old. And so there's just a lot of, it was learning on their part as well. And I think they did an amazing job at really understanding very quickly that whole kind of market. But I think, I think the one thing that they look for is like how consistent is each store's profitability? What are the gross margins? What are the four-wall margins? And what are your average transaction value? So for us, like if you're Blank Street, a business that's predominantly beverage focused, and we were kind of a 50-50 split between food and beverage. And so, you know, when they're looking at our business, they're trying to understand actually, can we make this type of business fit into our business, even though it's a much higher food count?
Yeah.
And that's why we picked the two sites that we transferred from Over Under to Blank Street first were our lowest food shops. And they were a huge, huge success. There was a huge success from taking them as over-unders where they were okay shops to making them really, really fire under Blank Street's brand. And that was really, really cool to see. Again, like I think when we were opening these shops, we'd slightly run out of marketing budget. And then, you know, it's amazing what a really amazing campaign that Blank Street put together, huge amount of effort behind it.
Yeah.
And you can turn these shops from doing 1,000, 1,200 a day to 2,000 a day from these tiny hole in the walls.
Yeah, so that strategic fit has to be there, not just the numbers as
exactly.
Well.
And I think, you know, you have a plan of how, you know, whenever you take over a business or whenever you buy a business, hey, this is how we think it's going to fit into our whole strategy beyond just the numbers. And I think there needs to be an ROI on the investment, but also it needs to fit, you know, from a personnel perspective, but also from a strategic perspective too.
Yeah. And what other pieces of data or information in the commercial due diligence process were they looking at? Was there anything that surprised you and you thought, oh, well, I didn't realize I have to do that?
No, one was, I mean, all of our leases. So every single one of our leases putting together any like revenue sharing contract, any sort of supplier contract, anything that is going to cause a potential liability to them, basically. And we need, you know, getting everything out of the woodwork that maybe has built up over 5 years that maybe you didn't think was a big deal, but actually is a big deal from a legal perspective.
Yeah.
All your financing agreements between all of your, you know, when we used to do a lot of asset financing coming out of COVID, what did that look like? Making sure that those are all paid off. It was a cash-free, debt-free deal. And so making sure that everything aligned on that front. I mean, it just took a lot of time to pull everything together. And also a lot of the time, sometimes they don't know what they're looking for until they kind of see it and go, actually, no, we need this, and then we need this, and then we need that. I also think we were fortunate in the sense that the team we were working with at Blank Street were super on it. And I think it was part of their thing that they wanted to kind of get through.
Yeah.
And I think we were very responsive to that, and they were very responsive to us. And that level of urgency, if you can let it just, it can dry out very quickly if you're not on it.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, time, just getting things, getting back to emails in a timely manner, giving them the information that they need in a timely manner, in an organized way. I mean, it's not like rocket science, but it helps keep things moving. And that was the one thing, if just keep things moving, just keep it going.
You know, we've had a successful transaction and, you know, there's a transition period. How long was the transition period?
I had a year transition. Yeah. I had a year transition. Working at Blank Street, which was super fun. It was amazing. Huge learning. And then, you know, merging two companies, two slightly different cultures, a lot of people. And hopefully we did a good, job. It was an amazing opportunity and loved working at Blank Street. Great people.
Yeah.
Great fun.
The next gig, Edify Systems. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So Edify has been born out of, I suppose, my frustration running and building and scaling my own business is that often we just didn't have the data and insights that we needed to make the right decisions. And working at Blank Street, where it's, you know, they take a lot of data and it's a very data-driven approach to making decisions, it kind of, you know, they had a whole team of really, really clever people, you know, diving into each of the data, really understanding the data points of like what drives the business, what drives profitability, what drives top line. And, you know, the operators and the operating team had the data at the palm of their hands.
Yeah.
And on a daily, regular basis. And I took a lot of those learnings kind of from my experience running Over Under, but also from working at Blank Street. And we started a new software called Edify that basically is an inventory management and reporting tool that gives operators the data and insights that they need to run a better business. And at the end of the day, if we can help operators, you know, run a more profitable business and know which levers to pull to drive profitability, that's kind of really what we want to do. And the problem is that a lot of hospitality businesses are not very profitable. And it's not through a lack of trying, it's not through a lack of effort, it's not through the concept, the quality. A lot of the time it's because you kind of, it's finger in the air stuff. You're making decisions based on gut.
Yeah.
And whilst that's important in hospitality, you need the data and the insights to understand and really drive the decision-making as part of that. And I think you can't use data alone, and I think you can't use gut alone.
Yeah.
But being able to combine those together in one easy to use platform, that's what we're trying to do.
Great. So thinking back to your days as an operator, what were the pieces of data that you finally learned were, this is essential information around my business?
I think that nothing can like completely like revolutionary, but there are three numbers that any operator can control on a day-to-day basis. And those are your sales, your cost of sales, your staff costs. And often, you know, those are the three things you control. You can control sales by upselling, you can control sales by marketing, you control staff costs by predicting and forecasting your sales. And your cost of goods is all down to do with recipe building, recipe management, understanding waste. You know, I just think a lot of systems that I had used were just not fit for purpose. They were often maybe not designed by hospitality operators. Yep. The support wasn't necessarily there. And I think what we're building, and we're at a very early start of our journey, is building a tool that actually is designed to use every single day for operators, built by operators. And I think if we can, you know, if we can help people run a more profitable business, that's where we can really help. And profitability helps solve a lot of the other issues within hospitality. And I think, you know, if you have a more profitable business, you can focus more on your team. If you can focus more on your team, they can focus more on the customer. And it's like this fulfilling cycle. And I think it's all driven from having that very clear understanding of what drives profitability within your venue.
Amazing, Ed. Thanks for joining us here today on Fifth Wave.
Thanks, Jeff. Pleasure to be here.
And that's all for this week's Fifth Wave podcast. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe and share the link with a friend or colleague. Also, if you're on Apple or Spotify, we'd really love a 5-star review to help us increase our reach across the industry. To stay informed, visit worldcoffeeportal.com to get access to all the latest global coffee news, including the weekly coffee dose, collecting all the big coffee news stories. Links are in the show notes. This episode was produced in the one and only Serendipity Studios in glorious Camden, North London. It was produced by myself, Jeffrey Young, Hannah Heath, and sound engineering by Chris Brister. And this week's song, in collaboration with the Coffee Music Project, is Cry Don't You by Cambridge-based artist Iona Sky. Until next time, stay safe, stay passionate, and stay caffeinated. On top of it.
but nowhere to go. Yet underneath all the heat and the noise, I'm staying for the ride all along, and I'm not sure I have a choice.